inventory report, we were somewhere around 6.1, 6.2 million total cattle on ranches and in feed yards.
That's the current size of the cattle herd in the state of Kansas. And today, Matt Perrier, fifth generation rancher from Eureka, Kansas, walks us through the rich history of the Kansas cattle industry. From those iconic Kansas cow towns to the expansion of the railroad, the arrival of the Black Angus in the U.S., and of course, the Kansas City stockyards and packing houses.
It's hard to imagine in its heyday seeing that many thousands of animals coming in there and being marketed, merchandised, and marched right back into a packing plant or onto another rail car and going somewhere else.
Plus, we'll talk about the evolution of the Kansas cattle industry since the early 1900s. But what you can't overlook is a state that literally has every facet of the beef industry inside its borders. That lends itself to cooperation between the rancher and farmers, to the feeder and the packer.
I think it makes it easier for Kansans to understand the need to collaborate and understand the need for all those cogs in the wheel.
You might be running a cow-calf or stocker operation in the western U.S. or a purebred outfit in the Midwest or the East. What does Kansas have to do with you? Tune in and find out on today's episode of the Working Ranch Radio Show. This is the Working Ranch Radio Show. I'm Justin Mills. As you heard there in the opening, we are talking about the state of Kansas today. More specifically, the ranching, the beef industry, the ag industry within that state that makes up what it is, what we see here today. Not only its history that we're going to be talking about, but also how that history has evolved into what we see here today and its impact to all of us here in the ranching industry. Whether you're in the state of Kansas or not, they play a part of our industry, and we're going to learn about that here today. But before we get to that, I did want to let you know, of course, as always, the Captain Tim O'Byrne, who is publisher of Working Ranch Magazine, will be in later on in the show for this week's edition of Tim's Two Cents, and of course, meteorologist Don Day in with a look at our long-term weather. But turning now to our guest, joining us is Matt Perrier. He's a fifth-generation rancher out of Eureka, Kansas, with Dale Banks Angus. Matt, thanks for joining us here today on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
You bet. Glad to be here, Justin.
Well, we've done this from time to time on our program where we reach out to different states. And the purpose of this is really for folks that listen to the show to understand the relevance, the importance that the respective state that we're talking about has to our cattle industry as a whole. And so when we look at what we're at today, the state of Kansas, and as you and I were talking before we went on air, I really think people need to understand there is a lot of our cattle industry's history and even present day industry that centers around the state of Kansas.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, we are the center of the contiguous 48 states, and honestly, we're kind of the center of that those cattle drives coming north as well. We just don't do as well at telling the old stories as my fellow Texans did of the history of the first cattle in the United States.
Yeah, nothing against the state of Texas. They were important, but everybody kind of thinks it all centered down there. Well, that's where the cattle came from, but it all ended up in Kansas.
They started there and headed them north toward Kansas, yes.
Yeah, when you look back on it, there's so many of the old TV shows. You know, you can go back to Dodge City, Kansas, and those cow towns, and that was a big part of that. And kind of walk us through, you know, that element and how that evolved into Kansas really being that core of our industry back in the 1800s.
Yeah, I mean, you know, between that stage, the heyday of those cattle drives, 1867 to 1876 or so was the decade. And they say more than 2 million Longhorns came north up the old Chisholm Trail to Abilene and then Ellsworth, Kansas. Of course, like you said, Dodge City, Wichita. There was a pretty major area at Newton and Baxter Springs down the southeast. There are scads of cow towns all through Kansas and probably more than all the rest of the western states combined, just because that was a central location and the time allowed them to get from Texas to Kansas before they then went on to Chicago or wherever the case may have been.
I thought it was interesting as I was doing a little research on this. The railroad was both initially what brought those cow towns to life, but it then, as the expansion of the railroad continued, it also then is what probably eliminated those cow towns, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was almost their demise. I've got a friend in Ellsworth who's a good old cowboy and has studied some history. And of course, Ellsworth was a cattle town. But every time any industry discussion comes up that we say, you know, it's this segment's fault or it's that guy's fault. And he said, you know, it all started when the railroads came in.
Yeah.
And he says it tongue in cheek. But yeah, I mean, there were a lot of things that changed once those railroads, especially once they got lines laid to other areas besides just Kansas. But yeah, there were shipping points at little towns, Bazaar, Kansas, Cassidy. And they handled as many cattle getting on the Santa Fe line as about any place around.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things too that was that we see with that, especially where you're located in the southern Flint Hills of Kansas there at Eureka, and that was the, you know, just the grazing, the type of grass that was available physically, there was a lot of draw to that. I mean, not only to get up to the railroads, but there was a lot of grass that was very valuable that also was, you know, those tall grass prairies that we saw, started to see, really was an evolution to this as well.
Yeah, and it was kind of the perfect time for those cattle. You know, even today, we are truly about a 3 to 4 month grazing land here in the Flint Hills. And that's why we have so many yearling type cattle that come in here in the mid to later part of April. And most of them today would just spend 90 days or so before they get back on trucks late July and go to the feed yard. But that is, it's as good as it gets during that time period.
Yeah.
And it's as bad as it gets from a nutritive value standpoint outside of when our grass is green. It's pretty rough. I mean, unlike short grass country that will cure out in the fall and you can get a little bit of protein and some TDN, that grass is hard to keep much alive without supplementing quite a bit of protein and other things. But yeah, during that summertime when they were driving those herds up here, let them over summer and then ship them out in the fall, it was perfect.
Mm-hmm. So as we move through that era, that time frame of about 1856 through 1896, when we saw the historic cattle drives in that era really being the crux of the cattle industry, and it was really centered, really nationwide centered around the state of Kansas itself, as we talked about a bit ago, the railroad was a part of that. But that railroad went east, and that was a big part of that, because what also was established in there was the Kansas City Stockyards, and that in itself was a pretty key thing as part of this industry as well.
Yeah, it was huge, and I, of course, was born too late to be able to see the stockyards in action, but have heard my dad and especially grandfather talk about going up there to Kansas City to watch cattle sell. And of course, a lot of times they'd even actually get to ride the train car with those cattle after they got them loaded from Eureka area on up to Kansas City and see the commission men sell those and then go on to Chicago and points east, as you said. But yeah, it was a huge opportunity because of our central location. And honestly, kind of bridging the gap from the early 1900s to today, it's kind of remained that because of its proximity to a lot of different areas, whether it be metropolitan centers and where our beef is consumed, but also feed resources and things like that. We've built feed yard industry and processing plants and everything else that continue to make Kansas kind of a hub for the beef industry.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at that time frame of when we saw the stockyards start to go, let's call that the, you know, from about 1870 on. But when we start getting into that point and a little bit later, we start to see the industry evolve just a little bit. And I thought it was interesting, too, because you yourself, your own family history was part of that in the late 1800s to early 1900s, as we know, and you're very well aware of this, and as a Angus operation yourself, the Angus cattle were imported from Scotland into Kansas in 1873. And that's where we started to see those English bred cattle showing up. And the state of Kansas was kind of the home to some of these English cattle that were showing up.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, prior to that, it was largely Longhorns and, you know, some more what we would kind of term native types of breeds of cattle. And yeah, I mean, my ancestors settled this place in 1867. Another family in 1869, and the daughter and son married shortly after that in 1903. And they bought their first Angus cows in 1904. And as you said, Mr. Grant brought those from Scotland to the little town of Victoria, way out in western Kansas. If anybody's driven down I-70, pretty small town, but that's where he chose to bring the first Angus bulls in 1873. From there, and it was a fairly slow burn, but from there, yeah, whether it be Angus or Hereford or Shorthorn, a lot of those English breeds caught on. Honestly, the Hereford breed grew quicker mm-hmm. in terms of population and use here in Kansas than the Angus, and probably we were a distant third behind Shorthorns and Hereford up to a certain point. My dad tells the story of hearing from his grandfather that people from Eureka and from all the counties around would come out and drive past my great-grandfather's place after he'd bought these first Angus cows, because they'd never seen an animal without horns, a beef animal.
Yeah.
And they'd never seen one with black hair. And so these novel polled black cattle, people would take a Sunday drive out into rural Greenwood County to see these beasts mm-hmm. that they'd never seen that weren't red and white with horns.
Yeah, I see that story. I had read that story about your family's heritage there. And I'm sure in light of all of the color that most people were used to seeing in cattle, first it was Texas Longhorn, and then, you know, of course, Shorthorn has a little color.
Sure,
Herefords,
sure.
We don't have a little color. It was probably quite a sight. You don't think about it today because it's, in some ways, it may be kind of the opposite.
Yeah, many, many customers through the years. I mean, I even remember when I was a kid in the 80s, the next generation would decide to use an Angus bull. And they'd have to hide him back in the back because they didn't want any of the neighbors knowing that they had black baldies. So they were so embarrassed that they'd actually gone out and bought a black bull.
Oh, that's interesting.
Kind of changed a little.
It sure has. My guest today is Matt Perrier. He is with Dale Banks Angus, but we are studying and we are learning about the Kansas cattle industry. And we've just went through some of the history of that. We're going to continue to work through that. We're about the 1900s or so. So we're going to continue to work through that. And as we continue through our program here today and our conversation with Matt, we're going to get into not only where we're at today and how it plays a role into our industry, but also where it's going. When we come back here, we're going to continue our focus today on the Kansas cattle industry. My guest, Matt Perrier, with Dale Banks Angus out of Eureka, Kansas. We'll be back on the Working Ranch Radio Show after this.
What if your commercial beef herd could be better than you thought possible? Genetic testing can help give you more confidence about what your herd is made of, and more importantly, what it can be. Inherit Select from Zoetis provides data-driven genetic insights to help you make more informed selection, breeding, and culling decisions about your cows and heifers. The journey from genetic potential to reality begins with Inherit Select. Ask a genetics rep how to save on testing with our whole herd promotion. Go to beefgenetics.com/radio.
Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. I'm Justin Mills. My guest today is Matt Perrier with Dale Banks Angus out of Eureka, Kansas, as we are studying and learning and talking about the importance of the Kansas cattle industry, not only its history and its and where it plays a role in what we're seeing today, but also the future of where we're going with our industry as well. As I said, Matt Perrier is my guest. His family's heritage goes back to the 1860s and even into 1904, as we heard in the last segment, when their family purchased their first Angus cattle. And Matt, as we go through this today, as we were talking a little bit off air, you said, well, I don't know how much you want me to talk about our family's heritage. Please feel free, as we're talking through, moving through these 1920s and into the 50s and so forth, as we talk about that next segment of the industry, to insert your family's heritage in this, because I know it followed very closely to what we saw in the state of Kansas and how that evolved as well. So we were talking a little bit ago about the Kansas City Stockyards and that being a major part of the industry kind of after or the tail end of those cattle drive eras and the cowtown eras of the mid-1800s. The Kansas City Stockyards, as you said, much as it is similar today, the Kansas City area in the state of Kansas, very central to our country and plays a big role in that element. And when you look back over there, the heydays of the Kansas City Stockyards was about 1923 when they traded 2.6 million head of cattle. And that really began to be a big part because we also saw in that time frame of these packing houses developed. And Kansas City was a key part, only second to Chicago, of the cattle processing industry.
Yeah, it was a huge part. And that was very forward thinking at the time of trying to put all those cattle, all those pens, all those catwalks and opportunities to merchandise and market those animals right next to the packing plants and, you know, refrigerated rail cars. And so many things happened very, very quickly after that out of a necessity, really, because as Americans developed a taste for high quality beef, that demand spurred on more and more and more need for that supply, and much like today. But it was, again, I never got to see the Kansas City Stockyards in action. Luckily, I got to see some of the remnants before it all turned into the West Bottoms and some of these areas of Kansas City today. But it's hard to imagine in its heyday seeing that many thousands of animals coming in there and being marketed, merchandised, and marched right back into a packing plant or onto another rail car and going somewhere else. But yeah, it would have been a fascinating, exciting time.
Yeah. And I threw out the cattle numbers. I'm not even throwing out the pig and the sheep that processed and went through those same stockyards as well, and the packing plants as well. Matt, as we talk about that era, the turn of the century back in the early 1900s. And as the industry evolved, we talked earlier in the last segment about the railroads were a part of what brought the cow towns up, but it's also what started to see them dissolve away. In addition to things like barbed wire, you know, as we started fencing out places. So let's walk us through from your perspective, as well as your family's heritage, of what the industry would have looked like in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and up into the mid century of the 1900s.
Yeah, that one's always difficult for me because I think every family and every farm and ranch is a little bit different. But for ours specifically, I think our family, much like a lot of other folks across the Midwest at the time, they were pretty focused on growing crops. And I think quite often the cattle, at least in this area of the county and of the state, the cattle were almost a sideline to diversify. And, you know, of course, they had a milk cow and they had things like that. But the true big cattlemen were probably out there trying to put together big groups of steers from Texas and then commingling them and remarketing and things like that, as opposed to the families that had a small cow herd that was maybe, like some are today, a byproduct of land ownership and a diversification. But in our family's case, it started out as almost a novelty. My great grandfather Barrier, that first bought those Angus cows in 1904, he and his wife spent their honeymoon at American Royal, which is right across from where the Kansas City Stockyards would have been, or right in those same bottoms. And his mission was to go up there and see these novel cattle that he'd heard George Grant had brought to Victoria, and these Aberdeen Angus. And so they go up there in 1903. They see, finally, they looked all over the American Royal until they found this little display of Angus cows and decided that he had to own some. And again, when he bought those first ones in 1904, they were a bit of a novelty. Mm-hmm. It was different than your major big cattlemen that were running hundreds, if not thousands, or even hundreds of thousands of longhorns and things like that. And as the beef industry developed, and as the need for better beef developed, thanks to the folks in Chicago and New York demanding that, I think that made more of a reason to look more into just not just raising cattle and raising pounds of beef, but actually breeding better beef that laid down fat in a more efficient way and that grew faster and all these other things. So yeah, I think that it was a slow burn process, as quite often is the case in the cattle industry, on that move from the native Texas longhorns into more beef type English cattle.
Yeah. You had talked about the fact that the beef industry was maybe more of a side hustle in a way to the farming. And even today, I mean, farming is a very big part of the ag industry in the state of Kansas. I mean, it is the top winter wheat state, second all wheat in production in the whole country. So we know it's a big part of the industry. Where did we start to see maybe some of that? Because nowadays in our industry, we hear things like, well, you know, we got wheatgrass cattle. Well, that's a terminology that sprouted out of your part of the country, of Kansas there in Oklahoma.
Yeah, you know, I think that when we have cattle, we have options. And that's the neat thing about running ruminant cattle that can graze just about anything that we put in front of them and still convert it into high quality protein. And whether that is wheat pasture, like you talked about in South Central Kansas and North Central Oklahoma, or whether it's Flint Hills grass, and every year is going to be a little different thanks to moisture and drought and weather conditions and even markets telling us whether we need to pull those cattle forward or let them stay out on pasture a little longer. I mean, there's a lot of diversity within the management of these operations, and I think that that's historic. I mean, you go back to that time period you're talking in the early 1900s, we were somewhere between 10 and maybe as many as 40 years after the Homestead Act. And so ingrained into most of these people's mind was that if you want to own land on the frontier throughout the Midwest and the West, you have to prove that up. You have to show that you can raise, you can make that an economically viable business. And in Uncle Sam's eyes during the Homestead Act days, that means you have to grow something from the ground other than grass, which in this immediate area was very unfortunate that they tried to till up this native grass, because even to this day, the true native grasslands that they couldn't plow up because there were so many rocks and not enough water, et cetera, are way better grass country than those that they tore up in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and have now been planted back to grass. They've never been as productive. And so, yeah, man probably screwed up a pretty good ecosystem here through the Flint Hills. But yeah, cattle were not their primary source of income. It was crops.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take a break right here, Matt. And when we come back, we're not necessarily present day, but we're not far off in terms of where we're at in the industry. And I think let's, in this next segment, let's get into then where we're at today with our industry. Because I also want to make sure we leave time at the end to talk about where this is, where it could be going. Because I think we need to talk a little bit more futuristic in terms of where the Kansas cattle industry is at and in terms of how it relates to our entire industry as a whole. So that's kind of the steps we'll take here, folks. This is the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is Matt Perrier. We are talking about the Kansas cattle industry and its impact to our industry as a whole. And I think in today's day and age, you can say probably global industry to some extent as well. We'll be back after this.
Capitalize on crossbreeding with Gelve and Balancer bulls. Raise replacement females with added fertility, increased longevity, and greater productivity. Gelve and Balancer influenced females wean more pounds of calf per cow exposed. In the feed yard, Balancer influenced cattle offer increased performance, improved feed efficiency, and have excellent carcass merit. Balancers add the pounds, make the grade, and deliver the value. Make your crossbreeding count with Gelve and Balancer genetics.
Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is Matt Perrier. He's with Dale Banks Angus. They're out of Eureka, Kansas, and we've been able to tie in a little here about his family history a bit as we've talked about the Kansas cattle industry evolving, starting back in the 1800s, around the end of the Civil War time and on through, and we've talked through that time frame. And Matt, as we get into more our current present day Kansas agriculture, the demographics and what that looks like. We kind of talked a little bit about it in the last segment. We do know there's a lot of farming agriculture mixed in with cattle industry in that. So let's talk about what we see in regarding the scope and size of the Kansas cattle industry and its impact or its implications to our U.S. size and scope of our cattle industry.
Well, Kansas is obviously a leader. I think we bounce around between second and third nationally on total cattle numbers. Today, I think, or the last January 1 inventory report, we were somewhere around 6.1, 6.2 million total cattle on ranches and in feed yards. But the feed yard industry is a huge, huge part of it. Most of those feed yards are in the central and western part of the state. Most of the cows would be from the central to the eastern part. And okay. So for those that aren't familiar with our geography and demographics, the arid, drier, lower rainfall part of the state would be in the western third, and they would also have the Ogallala Aquifer and some wells and things that they can pull from, irrigation that they can grow wheat and some corn and things like that. The eastern side of the state, there's not much, if any, groundwater. It's all surface water, but that's quite often where the cows are. Mm-hmm. And especially like we talked about through the Flint Hills and areas like that is where we would graze a lot of stocker cattle and yearling cattle. We'd also have, you know, several of the larger packing plants. Three of the four would have at least a processing facility in Kansas. And so that would be a big, huge part of our business as well. And so I think there's a reason, as you look back in the recent history of a lot of these models that would put several segments of the beef industry together, whether it be in ownership or just for vertical coordination, a lot of them have started in Kansas because yeah. You've got the genetics providers, you've got the commercial cow-calf providers, you've got the graze and wheat folks and the grass guys, and then you've got a very, very thriving feed yard and processing industry as well. And so we all go to the same meetings. We're all in each other's backyards, and it just makes sense that we can kind of collaborate a lot in those regards as well.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about more arid in the west and more not as much in the east. Just from a precipitation standpoint, I thought this was interesting. I was doing that. And the average precipitation in the state of Kansas is 27 inches, which for a lot of us that I'm at a 15 inch. So I look at that and I'm like, man, that's great. Yeah. However, there's a big difference between eastern Kansas at 37 inches and western Kansas at 19 inches of precip. So that average, like you said, there's a big difference there that makes a lot of difference in terms of what is grown and what can be done there.
Yeah, no doubt about it. When I went to college at Kansas State, which is in Manhattan, which I would call in the north central, but it's probably kind of east of north central part of the state, I would get up there and think, man, this weather in middle August is really nice. The humidity is a little bit drier and the air is a little bit clearer. And the guys had come from western Kansas and I mean, just sweat their tails off. They thought it was absolutely a swamp. So that's how much diversity we have from east to west, both in rainfall, but also in production types. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a totally different mindset, totally different management culture. And yeah, we learn a lot from each other.
Well, and I think that too is one of the things, and we see that maybe you could even say, go to the states, it's north of you and on up through some of that Corn Belt area. You do see a dividing line between an arid climate and a humid climate. So it does make those states pretty diverse in the type of agriculture that you see there.
Yeah, not only agriculture, I even think that there's sometimes, and I don't know about Nebraska and others, I think it's probably yeah. so, because as I talk with South Dakota and North Dakota, mm-hmm. they always, he's from East River.
Yeah, yeah.
They're from West River. Yeah. We have, if you go north to south, and here it's Highway 81 mm-hmm. that goes right north and south through Wichita, which is far east of central Kansas, but a lot of the eastern Kansas folks decide that anything west of Wichita is western Kansas. But that, when you cross Highway 81, the farmers and ranchers, the further west you get, they look at things differently than we in eastern Kansas. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's the same as you go north.
Yeah,
I think it is, because yeah, I spent some time in Texas and I saw the same thing down there. But if grandpa didn't do it in eastern Kansas, we're probably not going to do it. And in western Kansas, if you can put a pencil to it and figure it might make a little profit, by gosh, we'll change.
We're going to give her a try.
Yeah, so it's always interesting to see. I don't know if maybe we just, the last few years we haven't, but maybe we get enough rain that we wash all of our risk tolerance away.
Yeah, there you go. So what else? I mean, when we look at the state of Kansas, we're talking primarily to the cattle industry, and we know that it's important. I mean, I'm a range, cow-calf range guy here in northeastern Wyoming, and when I'm selling 4.5 weight to 5 weight calves in the fall, I'm kind of relying on those wheat fields in your part of the country to be up and going. And when you guys are droughted out, it kind of affects a lot of us. But beyond that, I mean, just agriculture in general, you know, it accounts for $81 billion in the state of Kansas. It's the largest economic driver. And it really is. It's not only the cattle, but it's farming, dairy starting to grow in there as well.
Yeah, it is. And we do have a pretty diverse makeup of those dollars. And they fluctuate from year to year and even season to season. But yeah, it's a huge part. And I think anybody that's probably listening to this in your listenership, it's not surprising, but Kansas is one of these states that has way more cattle than people. We've got less than 3 million people, and we've got more than 6 million cattle. And mm-hmm. So 2-to-1 ratio of cattle to people, it's a huge driving force in our economy. And even so, as we talk with folks, whether it's Kansas City and Wichita, which are the two bigger mm-hmm. metropolitan areas in our state, but even Eureka, Kansas, 2,300 people, there's still a disconnect, maybe not as great of one that consumers in New York City would have with production agriculture, but you'd think everybody in Kansas gets it that, yeah, that much of an economic driver is important enough that we need to make sure that we take care of the beef industry. But that's not the way you get to Topeka in any of these capital cities. But no, so we have a great story to tell. I think that we just need to continue to tell it.
Matt, is there something that we haven't talked about that people wouldn't know about Kansas, the cattle industry? I mean, we've sure talked about a lot of things, but I want to make sure, because I think every state has maybe some little gems of things that they are a part of the industry that maybe other people don't really realize. And maybe we've talked about a little bit, but we didn't expand on it enough. Is there anything like that we haven't hit?
I think probably one of the most valuable things, we touched on it before, is simply the fact that we represent all of those production segments and within, you know, sometimes a few dozen miles, if not a few hundred miles. And I think that enables us, when we can see both that operation in a different segment and the people that are doing that and either buying those cattle or feeding those cattle or processing those cattle or whatever the case may be, I think it makes it easier for Kansans to understand the need to collaborate and understand the need for all those cogs in the wheel. Now, we don't get to see the white tablecloth restaurants maybe in New York City or Chicago or wherever the case may be very often. But I think all other segments, we get to see those in action, and we understand, just like you said, how much we need that wheat farmer mm-hmm. in South Central Kansas to get enough rain that there is a demand for those lightweight cattle. Mm-hmm. On the other end of the spectrum, how badly we need to make sure that feed yard or that processing plant or whatever else has a product that will work for them, make them a profit, so they'll come back and buy ours the next time. So I think that's the neat part. It's kind of a microcosm of the beef industry right here within one state border.
That was what I was thinking as you were starting to talk about that. I was thinking, man, you guys probably, I'm not going to try to degrade other folks across the country, myself included, that because we're kind of in some ways, maybe more of a monoculture with our cattle industry. Some states are, because they do one or two things. And you're right. As a state that sees a lot of the different segments of the cattle industry, from the farmers that are needed to grow the feed, in addition to the ranchers, all the way up to the processors, probably you're a little more open-minded about some of that stuff than the rest of us are.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just nature of the beast. I mean, we're always more comfortable with what we know.
Yeah.
And when we know the people that are doing that business, they're not as frightening, I guess. Yeah. And I really had never thought about it like that until we got to discussing it here as to why, you know, maybe our livestock organization would look at things differently than other states would. But quite often that's it. It's just our, do you know these people that are doing that work? And if so, you're probably going to trust them and understand their business models a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, it's a model for all of us in the industry.
I hope so. I mean, I actually had a discussion on the podcast that I do, actually, is Practically Ranching, about this very thing. And that is the need for collaboration going forth. And none of us want to go the way of the poultry or the pork industries. But I had said this has been a year and a half ago, I had Joe Goggins on, and I said, you know, as independent as we are as cow-calf producers, all segments really in the beef industry, I think the only ticket that we're going to have to that independence is to figure out how to collaborate with other segments, not sell out, not necessarily give all the control to the packer or whatever else that might be a unintended consequence, but at least figure out what do we need to do to make sure that both you and I can be in business going forth.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Well, folks, we have one more segment. We're going to come back with Matt on, and not only are we going to talk about some more, I want him to talk a little bit about his podcast as well as some of their operation. But then again, I also want to talk about, as we look and go forward, some concerns, some things that he might have with our industry, as well as and how that plays into our Kansas cattle industry that we're focused on here today. Matt Perrier is my guest today. We'll be back on the Working Ranch Radio Show after this.
When your goal is to help animals reach their full potential, health matters. Diamond V offers a fresh perspective on animal health, a perspective that supports gut health, strengthens immunity, and enhances performance. For those who choose to invest in keeping healthy animals healthy, feeding Diamond V makes a statement about another dimension of profit, where margins are measured by confidence in your future. To get a fresh perspective, visit DiamondV.com, because animal health deserves a healthier approach.
Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is Matt Perrier with Dell Banks Angus. However, and I actually meant to mention this earlier, Matt, and I apologize for not doing that, but I wanted to make sure you had that we did mention. I know when I got your information about to, you know, give you a call about this, I'm like, where's that name? Where's that name? And then I remembered from Practically Ranching, which is your podcast that you do, a very good podcast as well. And that's a bi-weekly. Is that when that kicks out?
Every other week. Yes, yeah, that's correct. Yep.
So what are kind of some of the things you focus on that show?
Well, whatever it might be of interest, a lot like what you're doing here, whatever might be of interest to beef industry operations. I mean, we call it practically ranching. We're not actually ranching. we're practically.
Practically,
and,
yeah.
And it also, it has a dual meaning that we also do try to keep it pretty practical.
Yeah.
I have a weak spot for getting a little philosophical and talking about some bigger, broader issues. And sometimes we have a guest or two on that we may not solve anything. We may create more problems.
Yeah.
But no, I think the types of discussions that you're having here and I try to have on Practically Ranching are really healthy. I mean, mm-hmm. most of us are listening to these podcasts, bouncing along in a pickup or back of a horse or driving between feed yards or meetings or whatever the case may be, but it's a time for us to be able to hear about a new topic or a new discussion or a new thought, not necessarily have to buy into it and say, by gosh, I got to change everything, but at least give us a new perspective.
Yeah.
And that's what we try to do most of the time.
Yeah. And it's important that we really do try to educate ourselves about a lot of different things in our industry. As we kind of wrap up our discussion here today, Matt, we've talked a little bit about, as we move forward in this, you had talked about just even in the state of Kansas that is so, has such a heart and an element of agriculture on that state, there's still that disconnect between the consumers and agriculture. But as we move forward in our industry, what do you see as of today and then going forward that is going to be where Kansas agriculture fits in this, but at the same time is parts that we need to be aware of in our industry to move forward?
Well, I think like with any industry, there are going to be changes, and I don't know that any of us have a much shinier crystal ball than the next, but you know, some things that we all have to recognize is the changing demands of the consumer and what it is that they want and what it is that they're willing to pay for. And we went through for, gosh, decades, maybe a century or two of producing beef because we were cattlemen and because we knew that we could turn this weight of calf out or this group of cows out with the bull and we could make more beef. And when it came time to market those, we threw them all into the same feed yard pen. And depending on what Chicago Mercantile Exchange or a group of feeders or whoever said they were worth that week, we sold them all for the same money. And those pens, prior to the early mid 1990s, you go through a Western Kansas feed yard and you would see every color of cattle you could imagine in one feed yard pen. And you'd probably also see a couple rope and steers and a couple high influence Brahmin influenced and maybe even a couple of Holsteins in with a few black baldies and Angus and line-backed Hereford and whatever else. And then we scratched our head and wondered why the consumer said we had a consistency problem. Well, we addressed that. We listened to the consumer, maybe in some respects, maybe even listened too well, and have done some things that overshot the runway. But I think that we have to figure out how to connect. Even if they're going to live somewhere else besides cattle country, we've got to ask them what it is they want, figure out A, how and if we can meet those needs, and then B, how to pass those dollars from them to us. And that's what we did through value-based marketing. And hopefully there's some, again, unintended consequences. And I think some areas that we can even make that a better model. But yeah, we've got to figure out how everybody can make their portion of that consumer dollar and spread that through the chain efficiently.
Mm-hmm. You've really hit the focus in terms of the consumer side of things. And I do believe there's been, as much as we are concerned about the disconnect that consumers have about understanding what we do, likewise us about them. I think in that, and that's what you're essentially talking about. As far as how we're doing ranching, what's your thoughts?
Oh, it's going to change too. I don't know exactly how. As we look at, for instance, Western Kansas, we have relied on an endless supply of water under most of those feed yards and the corn fields that are raising silage and grain for those feed yards for decades. And the science tells us that aquifer is running low. And I think that we're going to see changes. I don't know how quickly. I don't know how much, but I think we will see. In fact, I just had this conversation on our podcast a week or two ago, that we will likely see at some point in the fairly near future a trend toward fewer days on feed, possibly different types of starch in that ration instead of straight corn, possibly even less of that corn and those products grown in Western Kansas. And so all of that is going to point to probably a little bit different type of management, type of animal. Another thing I think that we will eventually see are dollars that will reward traceability. And I know that's a buzzword. I know that's a lightning rod for a lot of folks, but there are enough places and enough brands that are saying, hey, there's value in knowing, the consumer knowing that, hey, this animal was born in Eastern Kansas, was grazed wheat in Central Kansas and fed in Western Kansas and harvested here. I don't know that it's going to get that specific, but I think there will be dollars strictly, even if nothing else, for the feed yards to know what's been done to these cattle from an animal health standpoint for traceability, and whether we see a two-tiered market system for cattle that are part of a supply chain or a traceability blockchain or not. I don't know how that looks, but sure, I think that's something that I would envision happening. And I don't think that has to be done a certain way, but I think that it does have to be done consistently so everybody can kind of use that data. So there'll be changes. There always have been. And we get a little heartburn as we go through the change, but just like everything, if it's a worthwhile change and it either saves us cost or it makes us more revenue in the end, we're probably going to figure out a way to get it done.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up our conversation with you, just briefly explain your current operation. I know you guys sell some Angus bulls in the fall of the year. You and your wife, Amy, you got a family as well. As we heard earlier on, I mean, your family's ranch goes clear back to the 1860s. So what's your operation right now?
Yeah, today, registered Angus operation, Dale Banks Angus, like you said, been owned by my family for five generations and hopefully continued on. We'll sell about 200 to 225 bulls annually. The bulk of those bulls are sold at our sale in November. It's always Saturday before Thanksgiving each year. The balance of them are sold private treaty right now in the spring and early summer. I think it would be pretty typical registered Angus outfit, mainly focused on making bulls for commercial cow-calf producers in the region and, focused on balance of traits. As I said, here in Kansas, we kind of have to, because you've got all segments. You've got people that are marketing to the highest of the high-end value-based marketing. You've got others that are selling in a more traditional way and keeping replacement heifers and are priding themselves on a good fertile foundation female that they're raising. And so as a mirror of that, we try to represent that in our genetic selection and management as well. So like I said, very, very focused on the commercial beef industry, as you can tell, with nearly every decision we make, and try to make genetics and bulls that'll go out and do the same.
You bet. Well, Matt, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Any final comments from you before we head out?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. History is always interesting to me. I know it's been said that if we're not a student of it, we're bound to repeat it. And and sometimes we have to learn those lessons the hard way when we don't pay attention to what folks have already learned. But the other factor I think is tough in the beef industry is sometimes we may rely even too much on it. As I spoke before, you know, we don't want to get too bound in tradition, but we can sure learn a lot of lessons from it.
You bet. My guest today, Matt Perrier with Delbanks Angus. As we talked about before, he's also the host of the podcast Practically Ranching. They're out of Eureka, Kansas, where they're in the Southern Flint Hills. If you want to go to their website at delbanks.com is the website. I encourage you to check it out. Not only his podcast, but also his newsletters. He was talking a bit ago about just kind of some philosophical sides of the industry that they like to talk about. A lot of information in his podcast, a lot of information in their newsletters as well. I encourage you to check them both out on your own when you get a chance. Again, Matt, appreciate you joining us here today and giving us the insight about the Kansas cattle industry, not only to its relevance within the state, but also its relevance and very importance to our national beef industry as well.
You bet. Thank you, Justin. Keep up the great work.
You bet. We're going to take a break here when we come back. Meteorologist Don Day steps in as we take a look at our long-term weather. And in addition, Captain Tim O'Byrne will be up next with this week's edition of Tim's Two Cents. We'll be back after this.
Looking for the perfect gift for a gardener or weather enthusiast? Introducing the Tropo, a precision rain gauge that has revolutionized both reliability and convenience. Expertly engineered by meteorologists, the Tropo gauge boasts rugged durability, impeccable accuracy, and precision to the hundredth of an inch. Visit measurerain.com to order a Tropo today and use code RAINDAY, that's RAINDAY, for free shipping and 10% off. Go to MeasureRain.com.
Hey, Justin. Hey, everybody out there in Working Ranch Radio Land. Easter blessings to everyone. Hope you're having a safe and productive calving season. Brandings are going to start coming up here pretty quick. And we've got a great issue coming to your mailbox here probably next week. April, May issue. Some really good stuff in there for you. We think about you folks out there all the time back here in the production offices of Working Ranch Magazine, and we love being able to bring you a magazine and a podcast like this and our social media every single week on that, six times a year on the Big Thick Magazine, and every Friday on Facebook we get sharing what's going on out there in cow country, and it is our honor to be doing that. Back to you, Justin.
All right, thanks, Captain. And as you were mentioning there, that the latest issue of Working Ranch Magazine, the April-May issue, is out. My wife just delivered the mail here from the mailbox, and there it was. I must have been on the front of the bus on that one, because typically I'm a little ways out before I get my copies, but I do have the latest issue of April-May. Working Ranch Magazine, by the way, if you want to get your subscription start, it's pretty easy by going to workingranchmag.com. Well, let's turn now, as we're joined by meteorologist Don Day, taking a look at our long-term weather. Who is on the road this week? Don, thanks again for joining us. And as I was kind of watching through last week, some of your podcasts that you were showing, and of course, we're seeing the weather that we're all experiencing here over the weekend. But it just seems like when you look up north, it's just like this incubator of all these future storms that we have coming.
Yeah, the North Pacific is the incubator. We're seeing them come off the Korean Peninsula, go across the North Pacific. They take a trip around the Aleutians, and then they're taking a trip southeast from there into the western United States. And that's what we saw last week with that storm that hit the Northern Plains. I'm driving through central Nebraska, and still lots of very large snowdrifts still in place from that storm. And we're going to see wet weather across the west and some of the central and northern areas as we go on into the next few days ahead. And as you said, there's an incubator, so there are more systems coming in behind it as we get the month of April started.
Well, and just like most spring storms, what I notice is that it blows in and it's kind of rough for about 18 hours or so, and then it just blows on out. And that's the one aspect of all this, too. They're moving relatively fast.
They are. That's somewhat typical of a spring storm. That's why they bring such drastic change. You can have really mild, nice weather ahead of these storms to then be into winter the next. That's what makes spring storm, you know, a problem, especially during calving operations, to where you just see that pendulum swing from one direction to the next and then back again.
As we look ahead for the next 7 to 10 days out, is there a certain part of the country that you're watching a little bit more, or is it just generally what we're seeing from west to east of these patterns moving across? But or is there a specific area that kind of watching or have some concern over?
Well, I think the whole country, the whole lower 48 will be affected by this active pattern. But we are seeing the storm track really favoring areas more to the north than we've seen lately. We saw that with the storm that hit Nebraska and South Dakota and Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin and into the Great Lakes. We're seeing the storm track kind of wanting to go a similar path across those same areas. I do think that there's opportunities for areas that need rain and snow, like parts of Montana and northern Wyoming, parts of western South Dakota and western Nebraska that should benefit from this wet pattern. But everybody's going to be impacted really coast to coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we always seem to talk quite a bit about the West and the Midwest a little bit. Let's just talk a little bit about the East Coast a bit and maybe the Tennessee-Ohio Valley areas. And in there, what are they going to see out of this?
They look wet. You know, it looks wet from those river valley areas you just mentioned all the way to the East Coast. There's been a lot of rain from Florida and the southeast states up the East Coast. We're really going to see some significant rain. It should stay liquid. There's a large body of modeling that for the month of April, for a lot of the central, the southeast, and the east, it's very wet. So there's no break towards a warmer, drier trend that's really going to last more than 2 or 3 days anywhere.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Don, I know you're on the road. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us a little bit and give us a look at our long-term weather.
Sure thing.
And again, you can catch meteorologist Don Day each and every morning through his daily video podcast at dayweather.com. Stick around. I'll tell you what's in store for next week's edition of the Working Ranch Radio Show after this.
What if your commercial beef herd could be better than you thought possible? Genetic testing can help give you more confidence about what your herd is made of. And more importantly, what it can be. Inherit Select from Zoetis provides data-driven genetic insights to help you make more informed selection, breeding, and culling decisions about your cows and heifers. The journey from genetic potential to reality begins with Inherit Select. Ask a genetics rep how to save on testing with our whole herd promotion. Go to beefgenetics.com/radio.
Well, I'm going to shoot straight with you. Last week, if you were listening, I told you that we were going to be having Leo McDonald on as our guest this week. However, he got tied up with things this week and couldn't make a chance for us to sit down and visit. So we're going to be having that conversation with Leo on next weekend's show, so be sure to tune in for that. We're going to be talking about the Product of the USA label ruling that come out from the USDA, so an exciting show that you want to tune in for next week on that. Also, later on, coming up in the month of April, Dr. Michael Apley with Kansas State will be joining us. Very interesting and very in-depth discussion on the status of using antibiotics, growth promotants, and feed supplements in our livestock industry. You're going to want to tune into that show as well. A lot of good information in that. By the way, if you do want to get a hold of me, it's pretty simple. You can send me an email at justin.workingranch@gmail.com. And by the way, if you hear an episode, you're listening back through them, or you hear today's episode and like it, let us know. Either hit the like, comment, or the thumbs up on the podcast provider that you are listening through. We appreciate that feedback as well. Well, the Working Ranch Radio Show is a production of Working Ranch Magazine, branded number one by America's Ranchers. If you want to get your subscription started, it's pretty easy by going to workingranchmag.com. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week. I'm Justin Mills, and until next time, keep your chin down and your mind in the middle. So long.